In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Betches Media presents...
He's in the building!
Afternoon Tea with host Sammy Sage.
Is that what you're saying?
Please proceed, Governor.
Presented by the Betches Sup Podcast.
Better hope there's a lot of girls listening to this with the volume turned down.
Your weekly dose of political therapy.
Cardi, that's what I've been doing my whole life.
And now, with this week's guest...
Well, there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded.
Your host, Sammy Sage.
Welcome to today's episode of Afternoon Tea, your companion to the morning announcements and weekly political therapy session brought to you by The Betches Sup. Today's guest is Anne Helen Peterson, writer, cultural critic, and author of the book Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. We chatted about a wide array of topics, including post-pandemic work life, how digital life has robbed us of hanging out with our own brains, and the problematic beliefs of male diet culture. With that, let's get the tea from Anne Helen.
Anne Helen, welcome back to the Betches podcast. How are you doing?
I'm amazing. I'm so happy to be here.
Me too. I love talking to you, and our audience loved when you were on Diet Starts Tomorrow a few weeks ago. So I wanted to have you on here because I know the SUP audience is really, you know, I feel like you are really perfect for them, and you write about so many interesting different phenomena relating to capitalism, diet culture. I mean, I was actually just before this reading something you wrote about bachelorette parties in Nashville. So
Range
is just like, it's phenomenal. So maybe just in case people, you know, didn't listen to the episode or are not familiar with your writing, which I feel like after this, they will all want to be. I guess maybe we just tell people kind of your background, how you came, you know, to do what you're doing. And yeah, just a quick intro.
Yeah, I have a totally weird story. I grew up in a small town in North Idaho and then left to go to college. I was a nanny for a while, went to grad school and ended up focusing on the history of celebrity gossip. So my PhD in media studies from the University of Texas is focused on the history of celebrity gossip. And then I was a professor for a while, and then academia is not great. So I transitioned from academia to write full time for the internet, which I had been doing kind of part time while I was a professor, and worked for BuzzFeed for 6 years. And I lived in New York for most of that. But then about 4 years into that time, I somehow convinced BuzzFeed to let me move to Montana, and did that in 2017 and have lived here in Missoula ever since. In September of this past year, I decided to turn my Substack, which I had been doing as just kind of like a free weekend type thing, into my full-time job. And now I do that full-time. It's called Culture Study. If you just Google my name and newsletter, it'll come up. And I write that twice a week and have a really great community there of subscribers and people who are really dedicated to it. But then I also write books. So I've written 3 books, two about celebrity, one about burnout. And then the most recent book that I'm working on with my partner and was coming out in December is on the future of like remote hybrid type work. So basically, what is it going to look like moving forward these next 6 months, next year?
Yeah, I honestly could not recommend your Substack more. Like, it's like having a little treat.
I try to make it that way. I try to make it something that like people actually like opening their inbox for, right?
Yeah, I really do. I loved something you wrote recently about, I feel like the headline that stuck with me was like, do you remember when your thoughts were no longer young and that you were no longer like on the cutting edge?
Yeah, I was interviewing one of my favorite journalists who is younger. She's in her mid-20s. And I love her writing because it reminds me that my thoughts are no longer young. Like, I think a lot of millennials, this happens with every generation, right? But like, we're getting to that age where we're like, oh, we're not the young people anymore.
Like, right. It's sort of like becoming like the washed up upperclassmen to the freshmen of yes. the world almost.
Yes, and we're like the fifth or sixth years at the college, you know.
Yeah. Or even like just the seniors who are like just over it and yep. on their way out, like half of them have graduated.
Yep. And have like a little bit of beer bloat and like kind of like struggle to get drunk anymore, right? Because like they've so normalized the rhythms of life right. at totally. College. Yeah.
Totally. So like, okay, so you were interviewing a younger writer who you're friends yeah. with. And I wonder, so I was thinking about this in terms of like Gen Z, because I do spend quite a bit of time on TikTok. And yeah. it's sort of, it's like you feel like the old person on this young platform, sort of like when your parents joined Facebook. Like so many sad analogies. It's like really pathetic. Yeah. So like, what do you feel like, someone was saying to me, I feel like on, maybe it was the last episode of this, that like the millennials are sort of like the shafted generation. Mm-hmm. That we are like not the most digitally native, but we, you know, we still have to deal with all of digital life. Do you feel like we've sort of been, do you feel that way? Like that millennials have been shafted? Like,
so I think millennials have been economically screwed, and there's a lot of data to back that up just in terms of like where we arrived post financial crisis and a lot of the different shifts in the American economy that have happened in terms of like how much more expensive it is and cost prohibitive it is to have a kid, buy a, like have more than one car or even a car, own a home, have a retirement account, have any sort of savings account, manage your healthcare. Like all of these things are much harder for us because of the ways that we essentially as a larger generation were stunted by the recession and the very slow recovery. At the same time, as an elder millennial, and you're a peak millennial, right? You're like a yeah. mid millennial.
I'm like the, when people were writing about millennials, now they don't write about us anymore. I feel like that I'm who they were writing about.
Yeah. So I am of the age where like some people in my age group, like don't even realize that they're millennials because yeah. they didn't identify with your age group as much. And sometimes people call that Xennials or Oregon Trail generation, whatever. But I was talking to Patricia Lockwood, who is an author and a very online person. And she was saying that she thinks old millennials, like we have the best digital experience because we knew what the internet used to be like. So we have a very vivid memory of when email was amazing.
I actually have that memory too. Yeah, it was fun. Like it was exciting to get because all your shitty things came in the mail and your fun things came in the email. And now yes. it's like wedding invitations come in the mail mm-hmm. and really awful things come. Like you never get like a great email. Like no one's ever emailing you that's like, you know, you are getting promoted and double your salary. Like that's never coming through email. Like no one's ever going to be like, you know, I discovered you and want to like, I don't know, like offer you.
Yeah, now it comes through like Facebook DM, Messenger maybe. Or like DM or someone texts you, all those sorts of things.
Right.
Whereas it was a really rarefied occasion. And also the other thing too, is that because especially like when I was in college, we didn't have cell phones, which is very difficult for people to understand how you would navigate college without cell phones. But
yeah.
I would just say that it was amazing. And we also didn't have Wi-Fi. Like everyone had desktops, right? Like that's where you did your typing and stuff. And so when you checked email, it was like, oh, between classes and then like at night, right? Like you weren't in this constant barrage of emails. So the good emails would accumulate and it would be a nice experience. And so we had, and also just the other interesting corners of the internet that I think a lot of older millennials, especially kind of people who are online now, were part of, like weird chat rooms or, you know. So we have this memory of what it used to be like and a nostalgia for that. But also I think that sometimes makes us resent what digital life has become as well.
Right. What do you think about, like, okay, so I think it's an obvious trope, but, like, you know, young people won't know how to communicate because they can't, like, make a phone call and they can't make small talk. Where do you stand on that? Do you think that that is just not actually going to matter? Because I do feel sort of grateful that, like, I was taught social cues in the midst of, like, adults who had some sort of etiquette rules. Like, not that I, like etiquette rules or anything, but it's more like, okay, I understand there is, like, a certain way you can act or a certain way you can't, and that, like, you need to feel that out. And, like, I do feel like because I didn't have a phone that I was, like, obsessively on until I was in college, that I did learn sort of how to read facial expressions or navigate, like, some of those more awkward things, like an awkward silence or having to jive with someone who you don't. Like, I feel like I did get that education a little bit. Do you think that's, like, going to be a thing for...
You know, I do think that younger generations have to figure out how to do that online, which is also awkward. But the thing that Gen Zers have told me is more difficult is that they don't really know how to be bored.
Right.
Like, when they're faced with a time away from their phone, they have not had, like, that experience is so foreign that it can feel incredibly anxiety producing. Sometimes I think, you know, when people talk about meditation, how if you're trying to meditate for a long time, like, some people have nervous breakdowns while they're trying to do that, like, they just start crying.
Yeah.
And part of it is that, like, your thoughts are really echoing around in your brain and you kind of have, like, an existential crisis of, like, I'm a person in the world walking, like, this, you know, that kind of, like, galaxy brain stuff. And I think that if you have not had much experience with having to really entertain yourself and really, like, figure out what it's like to hang out with your own thoughts, that's hard, right? Like,
yeah.
I spent so much time being bored when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Just, like, summer especially, like, somehow it was just, like, hours of boredom.
Right. And, like, what do you think? Yeah, I was also very bored as a kid. Like, I was, like, at one point I remember, like, my parents were like, don't say you're bored. Like,
yeah, boring people are bored, as Betty Draper would say on Mad Men.
So I forgot about that one. Yeah. And, like, I don't know what the hell I did. Like, I also remember being very bored in school in a way that I'm not bored during work because I can always just scroll on my phone or text someone or go on another website. Like, whereas, like, I remember being in school, specifically, like, Hebrew school, and having a watch and, like, looking at the minutes pass. And, like, I remember I would go into the bathroom just to go into the bathroom. And yeah, like, that was a thing you did in school just so that you could get, like, a change. And I don't know if I have the, like, mental stamina anymore to do that in a situation where I'm where it's unpleasant. Like I could be off my phone. When I was just out west, I was, like, skiing a bunch, and I honestly am too afraid to drop my phone off the lift.
Yep.
So I don't really check my phone for, like, a few hours.
Because you have, like, those thick mitten hands.
Yeah.
You're like, of course it's going to drop. Yes.
Right. I'm like, I'm just not going to risk it. I'm not going to take my phone out. So in that situation, when I'm, like, entertained, I can be off my phone for a few hours. But, like, I don't think I can barely make it through, like, a meeting without, like.
So it's so interesting because I think, first of all, I had very similar experiences in terms of, like, I just remember fourth grade being so boring that I would try to fake sick, even though I wasn't allowed to watch TV when I was sick. Like, I just had to sit in my room with nothing. I would try to fake sick because I was so bored. And then also during the sermon at church, like, so bored, just, like,
yeah,
doodling on, like, the leaflet that they would hand out in the bulletin is what it's called in church. Yeah. And just, like, and thinking that the sermon lasted like 90 minutes. I'm sure it lasted 25, right? But I also think that our minds, because we still have that capacity to go back to those times and those coping mechanisms. So something that happened with me, whenever I go to on a trip to a place where like you have to be in the car a long time. So I was recently in Southeast Asia, not recently, pre-pandemic, I was in Southeast Asia.
Week.
And in Cambodia and Laos, to get to a lot of places, you just have to like be in a van for 6 hours, 7 hours, right? And you can't, it's bumpy. So like you can't read. So what I would do is just listen to my, like listen to music on my headphones. I felt like I was in ninth grade again, like staring out the window and just listening to like, you know, whatever sad sax song that like the National on repeat, right? And I loved it because my brain went to these memories that like I hadn't visited in a long time. You know, our brains, there's so many places that when we're so busy that we like our brains don't allow us to go there. It was so great.
It's funny that you say that because yesterday I was just I was in the town that I grew up in on Long Island because long story short, I had to pick up a car, whatever. And I was sitting like at a red out of my neighborhood, there was this really long red light. Like it must have been probably 2 minutes. But when I was a child, like I called it the long light because like it lasted forever. And like I had a vivid memory seeing like the long light of this like when I would feel like I was crawling out of my skin for the light to turn green. And I'm thinking, I'm like, now I would just like text.
Look at your phone.
Yeah. But as you're saying like the sermon thing, I'm like, I used to make up games with like myself in my head. Like, yeah. And I wonder like where, like, was there value in that? And like, are we now missing that value? And like, what are our, because now I have no attention span. Mm-hmm. Forget bored. I'm not really bored, but I have no attention span. And it's like, I wonder, are our brains meant to be filled and satisfied all the time?
No, totally not. I think that our brains are really supposed to hang out with themselves a lot more than they are, right? Like right now, our brains, whenever we have that inkling of boredom, it's like you have this mechanism that your phone, you just open it. I have this thing where I like open apps. I'm like, I didn't even want to open that app, right? Yeah. Like I didn't want to, but my thumb just goes there. And
Instagram?
Yes.
It's Instagram. And nothing new is there.
Nothing. I'm like watching a Peloton instructor's story. Like, you know what? There's nothing there. But I think that you can retrain your brain, but it takes a lot of work to stop that automatic inclination. And for me, a lot of it too, is that those sorts of actions like that we do when we're bored, they're actually not restful, right? Like you can still be bored while you're looking at Instagram. And it's also not a form of like, you're not letting your brain recharge. You're not letting any of like the creativity juices go back up like you're a Super Mario character or whatever. And so one thing that I tried to do when I was trying to deal with my own burnout is try to think of all the spaces that I would fill with another voice. Right? Mm-hmm. Like I would listen to podcasts all the time.
Yeah, I do the same.
All the time. Like when I was walking my dog, when I was blow drying my hair, like anything that I was doing, I was like, got to fill it with another like thought. Because then I can like be multitasking and very culturally sophisticated that I'm like listening to all of these podcasts all the time. And I just had to stop listening to as many podcasts. I just had to cut out a lot of them and force myself to hang out with my own brain.
Yeah, well, what I've realized is that I also do the same. Like, I'm addicted to hearing voices, and I'm addicted to hearing them talk about, like, not soothing things. Like, I want to hear them talk about tense, scary things. Like, you know, and me, and what is that actually doing for me? Like, I'm not sure. Like, it's a coping mechanism, but also causing stress. You're working on, or I'm not sure if you maybe finished working on your book about post-pandemic work life.
Yeah.
And, I feel like we've become, I love working at home. I know a lot of people do too, but it is also not for everybody. And I guess I just would love to hear kind of like your take on what post-pandemic work life will be like, what the drawbacks will be of long-term spending most of our times in our homes, at least for people who are working, you know, in an internet job on the, you know, in an office kind of thing.
I think the hardest thing for people to get their brains around right now is that what we've been doing for the last year is not at all what it's going to look like moving forward, right? We have been working from home in isolation during a pandemic. And a lot of our, like, people have, their kids are home. Their partner is also at home with them all the time. You can't go to a co-working space. You can't go to a coffee shop. You can't work with your friends. Like, the ideal scenario is that whatever amount your office decides that you can work from home. So sometimes I think that, that's going to be the future, is like lots of different flex scenarios where it's like, come to the office 2 days a week, right? And then the other three, do what you want. And before the pandemic, when I was visit my friends in Seattle, we would all work from home together, right? Like my three best friends just at the kitchen table, like we were in college at the library, except we're working in our very different types of jobs. They would drop their kids off at daycare, so the kids weren't there. Someone would make lunch for everyone else, like a little like snack pack, like, you know, like that smorgasbord for everyone. And then around three or four, we'd go on a run.
Wow.
And then they'd go pick up their kids. Like, that's the ideal, right? You get to hang out with your friends while you're doing work. And I think that if you can do that mix of doing the things, doing the parts of your work that really need collaboration and need in-person contact, like, figure out how much there actually is. There's probably a lot less than you think, and have the, like, workplaces are going to figure out how to facilitate that. And then the rest of the time is really about shaping work to your needs and your schedule, instead of shaping your life around work's pretty arbitrary schedule of 9 to 6 or whatever it is.
Right. 9 to 6. It's like, okay, so you want the whole thing? You want all of it except dinner.
All of it. All of it is
except
yours.
Except dinner and like getting ready for bed is what, you, is what you're asking for.
Well, and when I lived in New York, so media time in New York, official hours are, well, it's all time, but official hours are like 10 to 6. But what that means if you're commuting in is, okay, so you if you get up early enough to exercise before
8,
work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and get on the subway at 9.
Yeah.
Then you usually don't actually leave work until 6:30, right? 6:45. Get home. Like, let's say you have it, like, pick up, even stop on at the little bodega on the way home to get some, like, some small overpriced thing to eat.
Yeah.
You get home at 8, right? Like, that is your day. That is your day.
Right. The whole thing is, it's kind of crazy when you, like, now that we've, like, been home for a year thinking about it. And then people would socialize after work, which is just the craziest thing I've ever heard. But so something you said about, you know, working with your friends in terms of like, what do you think the pandemic has done for friendship? I guess that's very open-ended, but I feel like you probably have a good take.
So I really think it depends on whether your friend group was on the same page about health decisions.
Let's say they were.
And Kyara, okay. So if they are, my friend group has never, I have not felt closer with my friend group for a long time. And I think a lot of that is that, like, there is this need to have some sort of intimacy. And this is even though, like, I don't live in the same place as my close friend group. Most of them live in Seattle, some live in Alaska and California. But I still feel that intimacy because we are checking in on each other more, like, the group thread is constant, and I think that, like, there is this care and attention to one another that had been lacking before. I don't, like, some people haven't had that experience, right? I think that they felt really distant, but I think that there are people who have felt a growing connection to their existing friends. But then I also think it's really, if you didn't have any close friends before, right? If you had moved to a new place and were just starting on that path to making friends, it's been a lonely year.
Right. Unless, you know, maybe you saw that you had something like really strong in common with one of those people you were like in transitional friendship with.
Totally. Some people, though, a couple people that I'm close with have made pretty big decisions, life decisions, because they've just, the pandemic has clarified, oh, this is the person that I want to be close to, right? Whether yes. it's a partner or close friends, like you want to be as in proximity to those close friends or family, right?
Right.
So.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. What do you think about like our generation and even Gen Z when it comes to friendship because of how like digitally connected we are? I feel like it sort of also ties into, you know, the time and the money because our time is so capitalized. I think about like, this might be unique, but my mother and my grandfather, my grandparents both had friends since they were like really young.
Yeah.
I also happen to be in that position because I also run a business with my friends.
Right.
But then you read all about, you know, how it's like kind of people are more lonely than ever. People have fewer friends, especially men. And we can go there next. So how do you think that like this is really kind of like played out for people? Do you think that like the digitization has harmed people's ability to kind of connect?
I don't think it's digital. I think for many millennials, it's that we are working all the time.
Yeah.
And that our jobs have really eaten up the rest of our personalities. And that includes like whatever is left of ourselves to invest in those friendships. And I think that it's like there was just a piece out today in The Atlantic that's about like, oh, if you let people work from home all the time, then they're going to be so lonely because they need to have friends at work. And I'm like, it's great to be friendly with the people that you work with or to start a business with your friends, but I don't need to be best friends with everyone that I work with if I have actual friends.
Right.
Right. Do you know what I mean?
I think that's what goes unsaid in a lot of things. And I think especially for people, like if you move to a city, you don't know anyone, you're mm-hmm. at work with them, like that's your friends. Like those are going to yep. be your close friends.
Yep. But, and also we don't have like those. So part of the book looks at the fact that like in the 20th century, for most of the 20th century, there are all of these different groups, like groups related to religion, but also just like social groups. So things like the Elks Club
or the Grange
or the Rotary, the Eagles, like so many different animals. Yeah. And they were in rural places, in urban places. They related to religion and race and gender and all sorts of things, but they were ways that we like hung out with people. They were how you found a support network for like if someone got sick, like that's why you had 30 people who came and brought you casseroles. It's right. because you had 30 people in this group who might not have been your best friend, but were connected to you and part of this larger safety net around you. And those groups began to decline as we began to like you can look at the graph, right? And see like, oh, the number of hours that Americans have to work in order to keep their jobs or to make ends meet goes up. And those membership in those groups declines, right?
Right.
So we just do not have that same sort of social cohesion as we did before. We don't have like a place, like there used to be when our parents were growing up, if you moved to a new town, there would be some version of what's called a newcomers club. And that's how you would meet people. Yes. Yes. Almost every town.
I think about my my husband's family, they're Orthodox Jews, and they still have like a version of this, like
yes.
where if someone gets pregnant or someone has a baby, like the community provides them meals for the next, like my sister-in-law broke her ankle and like people brought them meals. Like
yep.
No one would bring me a meal. Like, I don't even, there's not, like, even my close friends, like, they live across town. They're not going to bring me a meal.
There's some version of this that emerges when someone has a baby. You have, yeah. like, meal trains and yeah, that sort meal of thing. Train. And then I think that actually during the pandemic, the mutual aid networks that have risen up in various places have started to try to, like, say, yeah, we need each other, right? Like, we are bound to one another as humans who live right. in society together. And the fact that we've pretended otherwise for the last 40 years is a real anomaly. And yeah. everyone's pretty miserable about it. So what if we actually change that? The only way to do it, and this is kind of the argument of the book, is to stop making work like the primary source of identity and the primary thing that you orient everything else around. And that doesn't mean that like you go necessarily go part-time or that you're worse at your job. It just means that like when you're working, you're actually working really efficiently.
Right.
And not just like, what I find myself doing all the time is like, oh, I'm just scrolling the internet for 4 hours. And now I'm spending an hour writing the thing that I actually need to be spending, you know?
Yeah. But how does that work when like, I mean, you obviously have a very established career and you're now able to be independent on your own. So you're accountable to yourself. But, yeah. You know, what about like, how do you get employers? I mean, I am an employer, but I do feel like I'm sort of like on this page. How do you get like the more traditional employers on board for something like that when like someone else can just get a raise and a promotion and you need that because you have to care for a kid that you just had?
Right.
You know, how does it? Everything is so unaffordable that it gives businesses essentially like not unlimited leverage, but a lot of leverage. And it essentially puts no limit on what can be taken from like a person's life and
totally,
time.
Like the extractive value.
Yeah.
So one thing that I think more and more employers are seeing is that there is a limit to productivity gains of working all the time.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Right? So like right now, the number of hours that people have worked over the course of the pandemic has gone up, right? Like we are working more because work has trickled out into like, I roll over and I start working and then I, you know, work until dinner and then I roll over and work some more.
And you also feel guilty because it's like, where am I? No, like yeah. I'm in the living room. I was in the kitchen. Like, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, like, that's a whole nother conversation about the very real ways that we have to curtail that inclination.
Right, totally.
But like there's been a number of different articles as well that are sounding the alarm about the extent of the burnt out workforce, right? Like productivity levels are going down just because hours are remaining steady. Over the last 5+ years, our productivity has actually like either declined or stayed steady, right? So we're working more hours, but we're not doing better work or more efficient work. So some companies that are smart about this are like, oh, if I can figure out a way for my employees to do less work, but better work, let's figure that out. And so some companies are like, let's do a 4-day week, not 4 10-hour days, right? 4 8-hour days. And then with the promise of that extra day off, like it's this exchange of, okay, during those 4 days, we're going to work really intensely and smartly.
Right.
And then you have that other day off to recharge, to like do whatever you want. And you actually come back and do better work that next week. But you have to have this very forward thinking, like you have to be able to imagine that. And I think so many employers are like, of course, the more someone works, the better they work. That is the perfect employee is a robot who works 24 hours a day. And it's just not the case.
Definitely. I mean, you're totally hitting it on the head. Okay. I just want to go in one more direction before we do our final segment.
Yeah.
So we sort of touched on men in the friendship conversation.
Yeah.
And something you wrote about that I think kind of ties in an emotional way. You wrote about men and diet culture and how it's really gotten very bad during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like it all sort of stems from this inability for men to connect on any level of like real vulnerability, which both inhibits relationships and prevents them from really being able to like examine or even like touch on some of the maybe more problematic beliefs that in the male culture of like dieting and body image. So I wonder if you could just kind of like take us through like what you were saying there and like how maybe this could be somewhat tackled in maybe like a hopefully softer post-pandemic world.
Yeah, gosh. Well, I think it's improving a little bit with our generation. Like the more men go to therapy, the I think the more language, vocabulary that men and women have to grapple with some of these things. And I think that the problem, especially with diet culture and with body image, is that it has just been such a feminized component of our society. It's like only women care about what they look like, which is such a lie, right? But it is a lie that is pervasive. And so when and if you talk about it as a man, that becomes like a feminized thing, right? And things that are feminized coming from men are oftentimes viewed as weak or as somehow overly vulnerable, instead of what they actually are, which is like admitting that men too are subject to like the impossible ideologies that we have about what bodies should look like. And I actually think like there is a very narrow understanding of what a woman's body should ideally look like in American society, but there's a really narrow understanding of what a man's body can look like too. Right. It's just slightly expanded. And especially it depends too, like whether you're straight or gay, like there are different understandings that accompany that as well. And I think that the people that I have interviewed who are experts in food culture and in diet culture, they've done a lot of reporting that is pretty sad about like how alone a lot of men feel who are struggling with these things, because there isn't a shared vocabulary. There isn't a way to talk about it. You know, I think that like women, sometimes the way that we have these conversations can be really toxic, but at least there's a conversation happening.
Right.
Whereas I think that a lot of men feel very like it's not something that you could ever talk to someone about, or even admit that it's a problem.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's one of those symptoms of like, you know, a very common problem that shows up with the male friendship, which you could argue shows up with some of the violent aggression that we see from men in society. And I think a lot of it kind of goes to the fact that like men are not really allowed to connect on deeper things. And so they connect on going to the gym and who can go harder, and kind of couch it in this like language of, you know, life hacks, as you know, was in that article. I think a lot of these problems have kind of the same root cause, or a tangential one.
Yeah. And I think that, well, the thing that I always think about with men who have struggled with friendships during the pandemic is it's such a symptom. This is speaking very broadly and very generally, but most men that I know are not very good at making plans. Right. Yeah. And to do something during the pandemic, you have to be able to make detailed plans. Right. Like you have to like really set, like be like, okay. And especially if you're going to hang out like in any way together or something. So like I have to isolate for 14 days and like, how's that going to work and that sort of thing. Or like, who's going to set up their backyard and make sure there's a heating apparatus and all that sort of thing. Like,
yeah.
Some men are good at that and some men are very, very bad at it. And I have seen a lot of male friendships atrophy during this time. And I wonder how that's going to be repaired.
Well, planning is on some level a vulnerable thing to do.
Yes.
Because you are saying, I care enough to make this, like, I care. I care to put this effort in to something that is not like, you know, I don't know.
And, you know, caring. I was going to say a bad word, but like that's something, caring is something that I think we do associate, like we feminize that. It's like,
yes.
Oh, like you care enough to do this sort of thing, right?
Right, right. Which,
yeah, I care enough that I want to hang out with you that I'm going to make plans.
Like, right. Like great. I care. What else is there in this world? Like, what do you want me to do?
Like, not care?
Ever? Like, yeah.
We all dread the what should we have for dinner question. I know I do. I love a home-cooked meal, but I don't always have the time, energy, or groceries to make it happen. Being able to feast on a delicious meal without the long prep and cook times is what drew me to Home Chef over the other guys. Home Chef's meals are effortless, so I can spend less time trying to be top chef and more time watching it. Whether you prefer classic meal kits with pre-portioned ingredients and easy instructions, speedy recipes ready in less than 30 minutes, oven-ready kits with pre-chopped ingredients, or quick microwave meals that assemble in minutes, minutes, Home Chef has you covered for delicious meals without the hassle. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. Home Chef has over 30 options a week and serves a variety of dietary needs, so you never have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your first box. Go to homechef.com/feverdream. That's homechef.com/feverdream for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard that right. homechef.com/feverdream. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
But I think this is a good part to move on to our final segment. Something I do with every guest is I ask four questions. They're the same. It's really just like get to know, you know, who we're talking to. Okay, yeah. So one, what is your happiest memory?
So I will choose one that is, since we were talking a little bit about this, is I lived in my college town the summer between my junior and senior year with a bunch of my friends. And like most of the college wasn't there. And we didn't really have internet. And we just like worked our part-time jobs and like ate burritos and hung out, you know, just like without the pressures of adulthood quite there yet.
I can totally relate to like that time being the best.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. It really was. Oh, the lack of extreme pressures. Okay, next question. If you could go on vacation with any two people, who would they be? They could be dead or alive. Who would they be and where would you go?
Oh, my gosh.
So, like, you're a trio on vacation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is so hard because, like, I think it would be – like, wouldn't it be fun to go on vacation with, like, Britney in 1999?
Yeah, that could be your answer if you want it.
But like maybe it wouldn't be fun because the paparazzi would be there all the time.
This is, you could go to a secluded island. You can go anywhere. Okay,
what if I could go to a secluded island with Jennifer Aniston and Angelina Jolie and they would like both tell me all about Brad Pitt, but also like all about that the truth behind all of the gossip stories. Does that work?
Yeah, I mean that's maybe my favorite answer because most people choose like their idols, or like a or like their family friend, like a family member.
No.
But no, that is an amazing answer, and I'm like kind of with you on that. you never get that chance. Although, no. You know a good one: Meghan Markle and Kate Middleton.
Yes. Yes. Well, and here's the thing. Part of the reason I was thinking about Angelina Jolie and Jennifer Aniston is there's a great article that just came out in Vogue about how there is this pressure to, like, you can only be one team.
Yes. Especially
even though
it's
actually the dudes that are making all of these problems. And how that creates this scenario of like women have to always be solitary instead of in solidarity with one another.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have seen that movie before.
Yeah.
Totally. I'm going to read that after this. Yeah. Okay, third question. What are you terrible at and cannot be trusted with?
I am terrible at directions. I think I'm very good at like sense memory. Like I always know where my car is. But until I was quite old, I thought that whatever direction I was north. Like facing, like if so I'm facing funny. You, that's north.
That's hilarious. That is really funny. I also like don't really know the difference between left and right. Like I kind of like it really takes me a minute. So
I'm left-handed, so I think that really helps. So,
yeah, that's a good one. Okay, last question. If you could solve any one of the world's problems, like what would you pick?
Oh man, I would get rid of capitalism. Is that too big?
No, that is like the size we're looking for in this question. Okay, so no more capitalism.
If you get rid of like extractive capitalism, you solve a whole lot of problems.
Right. So what are we doing in the post-capitalism world?
We're just like living together with one another and caring about one another. We're caring.
Yeah. Consider the commune. I read that piece of yours. Yeah. Okay. Like I'm really a huge fan of your work, as you can tell. All right. This has been the interview. Everyone go subscribe to Culture Study. It is such an interesting newsletter and it's always like a little bit different every time, which I love about it because it's not like It could be anything. It's like opening a box with a surprise.
It could really be anything.
It's like a Kinder toy. Do you ever have that before?
Yes, totally.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So check that out, the Culture Study newsletter. Where else can people follow or...
You can find me on Twitter, and I have my Instagram, Anne Helen Peterson, is mostly my gorgeous dogs, so you can find me there.
Well, I'm sure some people will want to follow that. Great. Thank you so much. This has been an awesome episode, and thank you for listening to The Afternoon Tea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Afternoon Tea is produced by Sean Kilby and Jorge Morales Pico. Our editor is Stacey Wong. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Guest booking by Nicole Pellegrino. Be sure to follow @Betches_sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send us your emails to suppod@betches.com. Betches.